that, my friends, are just two hands making all that wonderful noise. That's Tito Puente, the master of the timbales, with 4x2. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, September the 5th, and efforts by President Obama, now in Russia for the G20 summit, to win international support for military action against Syria are beginning to show few early signs of success. China joined Russia in speaking out strongly against an attack on the Assad regime. Before the crisis escalated, of course, the G20 gathering was supposed to be focusing on concerns of international monetary policy, but Syria, no doubt, will creep into that and occupy a certain amount of attention. On the eve of the summit, the president had again forcefully made the case for a strike against Syria, saying that the world had to act against the regime of Bashar al-Assad to maintain credibility for a global ban on chemical weapons. But President Vladimir Putin of Russia, the summit's host and an ally of Assad, maintains that his position is that the United States is lying about the Syrian rebels and sanctioning aggression. We take a look today at the Syria crisis with William Bloom. He's an author, historian, and renowned critic of U.S. foreign policy, and the publisher of the Anti-Empire Report, which is available online. Among his many works are Killing Hope: U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. You'll recall that he was a guest with us describing the contents of that book, a really extraordinary work. I encourage you to get it. America's Deadliest Export: Democracy, the Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. West Bloc Dissident: A Cold War Memoir, and Freeing the World to Death, Essays on the American Empire. Bill, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, issue number 120 of the Empire Report, the Anti-Empire Report, has been published, and of course, it's no surprise that Syria takes center stage in this particular edition. What should we understand about the crisis now in Syria?
Well, one of the main things to understand is that the U.S. government has not yet given anything approaching clear and solid evidence that the Assad government was behind the chemical attacks, assuming even that these attacks actually took place. The Russian government has been for some time now, for a few weeks, been arguing the other way. They were saying that the attacks were carried out by the rebels, and they have given very good reasons for it. And they came out just now with a long report. It will be interesting to see how much of that report is even mentioned, even by name, in the Western media, the free Western media. I suspect it will be virtually unheard of there.
Could you course us through some of the points made in that report?
The Russian report, well, it just came out. I haven't read it. But they've been arguing that, one thing, it's absurd to think that Assad would conduct such an attack when his forces are winning the war. That makes no sense. They also say it's absurd to think that they would conduct such an attack while the UN inspectors are in the country. The inspectors were there to investigate allegations, previous allegations of chemical warfare use, charges made by both the rebels and the government, and the inspectors were there to examine the evidence for those allegations. And while they were there, came this new charge of an attack by the Syrian government. So the Russians are arguing, it's also absurd to think that they would do this while the inspectors were in the country. It makes no sense. And the Russians have shown videos, which I think are available on YouTube, one showing a cave full of equipment which the Russians claim are the chemicals and the other equipment needed for chemical warfare. They have a video of that online, and they have other videos. So the Russians have really been pushing this case. It'll be interesting to see whether at the G20 summit, which begins today, whether Putin or anyone else there will make mention of this report.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has backed President Obama's request for permission to take military action against Syria. But from a world view, there isn't very much in the way of allies to the U.S. this time around, with the exception possibly of France. Why do you think that the support is so thin for President Obama?
Well, one major reason is what happened with Iraq. The U.S. was making similar claims before that war began, claims about Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction, and they turned out to be false. That's one reason why people are skeptical now, especially since the U.S. government has not presented any hard and clear evidence of their claim. They can't get away with saying it's classified. That's silly. They're going to have to, if they have the evidence, they're going to have to present it to the world in its full beauty. That's one reason that the support of the U.S. has been so thin. And another reason is that the world is very tired, I think, of all these wars in the Middle East and elsewhere, especially the U.S. being behind them. This is the idea of the U.S. engaging in yet another war in the Middle East, after all the horrors that we've carried out and all the farces and the failures. The very idea of starting another one so soon after the others are barely completed really bothers people greatly. Even in the U.S., the support here for the amongst the public for the war is very thin. They may very well be able to get the Senate and the House to vote for an attack, but those are not your normal people. They are not the average American. The average American is, all the polls show, is very, very much against another war.
Well, I'm looking at the headline of issue number 120 of the Anti-Empire Report, and it says, "Found at last. After searching for 10 years, the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction have finally been found in Syria."
Yeah.
Could you talk about that headline?
That's what it comes down to. They couldn't. It's amazing how much people will believe how large their gullibility can extend. You would think that everybody by now would be at least fairly skeptical of any such claims by the U.S. government. And I mean, most people are. Your polls show that. But still, you have a large percentage of the American public for whom too many lies is not enough. They will continue to believe in the U.S. government, in our claim of exceptionalism, which we're all taught starting in the kindergarten, and we absorb that lesson very well. So it's very difficult for the Irish American to accept the idea that their exceptional country can be so cruel and so lying as to continually carry out these horrible wars. But still, to have gotten a majority of the people to vote against this extension, this new war, that's an accomplishment, and I'm makes me fairly optimistic for the future.
But how did you make that connection between the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and now found in Syria?
Oh, that was a joke.
Okay.
I mean, metaphorically found. Of course, they couldn't find it in Iraq, but they now found it in Syria. Oh, it didn't occur to me that anybody would take it literally.
But if they
found weapons in Syria, how would they ascribe them to Iraq?
If the Assad regime, let's just say, if there were chemical weapons used in Syria, where did they come from, you think?
I should know that, and I think I did know that, but I forget. It might have come from the U.S. The U.S. is the main supplier of such things. They supplied Iraq with all the WMD, the hardware and the actual chemicals and so on. That is well documented. So the U.S. has no record of being opposed to such weapons. It's only they choose to be against it when it suits them politically. But where Syria got it, maybe from Russia. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk to you about the missing link, possible missing link in all of this. The story about the Benghazi link here. Do you see that? What is the link with Benghazi? You had made before a link with Benghazi between Libya, Benghazi, and Syria.
It's very ironic. If the U.S. attacks Syria now, it can only help to put into power the same kind of people in Syria which are in power, partly in power in Libya, who carried out the attack in Benghazi. Any attack upon the Syrian government is going to weaken them, and increase the chances of the Al Qaeda linked rebels coming to power. And in Libya, they're still fighting in Libya to come to power. It's the Al Qaeda rebels supported by the U.S. against other factions in Libya, and I don't know how that's going to turn out. But that happened because of an attack upon Libya by the U.S. and NATO. 7 months daily bombing back in 2011, was it? Which that's what enabled the Al-Qaeda rebels in Libya to achieve a measure of power. And that's what's going to happen in Syria if the U.S. keeps on attacking the Assad government. It's amazing how they haven't learned anything and how stupid they are. And they'll talk about the danger of Islamic terrorism every day of the week and the dangers of Al-Qaeda and so on. But at the same time, it's a fact that the U.S. has fought on the same side as Al-Qaeda. Now, this is at least the fifth country they have fought on the same side as Al-Qaeda. The first time was in Afghanistan in the 1990s. The second time was during the Yugoslav wars and on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Bosnia and in Kosovo. And then in Libya, the fourth time, and now the fifth time, the rebels in Syria. Five times fighting on the same side as Al-Qaeda, about whom we're taught every day of the week in all our media that they are evil incarnate and our great enemy, and yet we keep fighting on their side. There's something very odd about U.S. foreign policy, is there not?
It would seem to be that way for any sane-minded person. Assuming that, in fact, this measure is backed, but when the whole committee returns on the 9th, when the Senate gets to vote as a whole on this measure backing the president's request, and then it comes up again for another vote in the House, assuming, let's say, that the president does get the green light, what do you think the fallout would be domestically in the United States and globally?
What do I think the fallout would be?
Yes.
Well,
if in fact the president does go ahead and attacks Syria.
Oh, if he attacks Syria, yeah, it'll be a very sad day for all the peace-loving people of the world, and for especially for the people of Syria. They don't need any more horror. The world doesn't need any more horror. We are soaking wet with horrible events every day of the week, and the last thing we need is another attack upon another country, which is not threatening us. The U.S. is not at all threatened by Syria, and the world and the Middle East do not need another war. It's going to be a very sad day if that happens.
Well, thank you, Bill Blum, for being with us today and giving us this other peek about the same situation that everybody is looking at, but from an entirely different perspective. Thank you so much. And how do people access
my website address?
How do people get to the Anti-Empire Report?
They can go to my website address and read all about my books and sign up for the report, which is a monthly and it's free. They can go to William Blum. .org, and that's the Blum was spelled B-L-U-M.
Thank you, Bill.
Much, my dear.
Thanks again. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, the vote yesterday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was an affirmative vote, saying that they have prepared essentially the document that the whole Senate would vote on when they reconvene on September the 9th, next week. The committee voted 10-7 in favor of the resolution, with only one senator, that is the newly elected Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, voting present. He didn't vote yay, he didn't vote nay, he just said, I'm here, and that's it. It's a very interesting vote. The resolution sets a 60-day time frame for President Obama to act within the so-called limited strikes that he wants to wage on Syria, with a possibility of a 30-day extension. The new resolution also would bar the use of ground troops in Syria. Two Democrats, Senators Tom Udall of New Mexico and Chris Murphy of Connecticut, joined five Republicans to oppose the resolution. Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky and Marco Rubio of Florida, two likely presidential contenders in 2016, were among the Republicans voting against it. That's very interesting. The close vote in the committee signals a battle that we could expect next week when it again comes to the Senate floor. But Rand Paul has been predicting that it will pass in the Senate. So I thought that I would share with you the impassioned plea just before the Senate took its vote by the Secretary of State and a fellow senator, John Kerry, trying to explain why it is important for this committee and for the Senate and ultimately for the House to endorse the president's desire, because it is supposed to mean a lot of things at a number of levels. I just wanted to play that for you. It's relatively short. A nice little clip into the workings of the Secretary of State's mind. But what you want to do is pay attention to how he makes the case. We'll come back to that right after this clip. So let's listen to Secretary of State John Kerry addressing the members of the Foreign Senate, Senate Foreign Relations Committee as they contemplate this request of the president.
Senator Paul. Thank you for coming today. It's not often that I get to compliment the president. I can probably count the number of times maybe on one hand. But when I first heard that the president was going to come to Congress, boy, was I pleasantly surprised. I was proud that he was my president. I didn't vote for him, and I still am opposed to him quite a few times. But I was proud that he did this, and I was just about to stand on my feet and clap and give him a standing ovation. And then I heard, well, but if I lose the vote, I'll probably go ahead and do the bombing anyway. And so it does concern me. I want to be proud of the president, but every time I'm just about there, then I get worried that really he doesn't mean it, that he's going to sort of obey the Constitution if he wins. So I heard Secretary Kerry say, if we win, sure. But if we lose, what? I mean, make me proud today, Secretary Kerry. Stand up for us and say, you're going to obey the Constitution, and if we vote you down, which is unlikely, by the way, but if we do, you would go with what the people say through their Congress, and you wouldn't go forward with a war that your Congress votes against. Can you give me a better answer, Secretary Kerry?
I can't give you a different answer than the one I gave you. I don't know what the president's decision is, but I will tell you this. It ought to make you proud because he still has the constitutional authority, and he would be in keeping with the Constitution.
Well, I disagree with you there. I don't believe he has the constitutional authority. I think Congress has this. Madison was very explicit. When he wrote the Federalist Papers, he wrote that history supposes, or the Constitution supposes what history demonstrates, that the executive is the branch most likely to go to war, and therefore the Constitution vested that power in the Congress. It's explicit and runs throughout all of Madison's writings. This power is a congressional power, and it is not an executive power. They didn't say big war, small war. They didn't say boots on the ground, not boots on the ground. They said declare war. Ask the people on the ships launching the missiles.
Syria is also important because, quite simply, and I can't say this strongly enough to all of you, many of you are parents. You know how lessons are learned by children. Many of you at school may have confronted at one point or a time a bully on the block or in the building. I think, quite simply, common sense and human experience and reality tell us that the risk of not acting is greater than the risk of acting. If we don't take a stand here today, I guarantee you we are more likely to face far greater risks to our security and a far greater likelihood of conflict that demands our action in the future. Why? Because we, as confidently as we know what happened in Damascus on August 21st, we know that Assad will read our silence, our unwillingness to act, as a signal that he can use his weapons with impunity. After all has been said and done, if we don't now, knowing that he's already done this at least 11 times that our intelligence community can prove, and here in this grotesque larger event, larger than anything that's happened before, if we back down, if the world backs down, we have sent an unmistakable message of permissiveness. Iran, I guarantee you, is hoping we look the other way. And surely they will interpret America's unwillingness to act against weapons of mass destruction as an unwillingness to act against weapons of mass destruction. And we will fight for the credibility to make a deterrent against a nuclear weapon as meaningful as it should be without that fight. North Korea is hoping for ambivalence from the Congress. They're all listening for our silence. So the authorization that President Obama seeks is distinctly and clearly in our national interest, in our national security interest. We need to send to Syria and to the world, to dictators and terrorists, to allies and civilians alike, the unmistakable message that when we say never again, we actually don't mean sometimes. We don't mean somewhere. We mean never again.
Well, that's your Secretary of State, John Kerry. This drama that is playing out before our eyes, in fact, is so serious, not only, of course, for the immediate consequences, but serious with respect to the relationship that the electorate allegedly is supposed to have with the mechanism in charge of governing them. And the government is prone to lying. We know that. We cannot ever forget that the first purpose of government, one of the chief functions that it serves, is to lie. That was right out of the classical works known as the noble lie. The governments all over the world make a decision that in some cases it is actually the nobler thing to do. You lie for the greater good. Because if the issue of chemical weapons is such a really horrible issue that even provokes a country like the United States to basically wage war on another country, then is it not, if we were to flip that coin, is it not within the rights of other countries to do the same to the United States on the same premise? What is the same premise? The same premise is that the United States itself has produced chemical weapons and has provided many dictatorial regimes with chemical and biological weapons. So, which is the greater sin? The person who uses the weapons, or the country that uses the weapons, or the country that manufactures and makes available those weapons? How the United States at this juncture chooses to sever the two is very interesting, because there you have the President of the United States in the world community of nations, and they're all chuckling because these are his equals. They know how this works. They're not fooled. They're not children born just yesterday. They know intimately the history of war and warfare. They know intimately the arrangements that are made with respect to the supply of arms of all types. And in that industry, the United States is right at the top. It will arm both sides because it makes money, or because it achieves a diplomatic and a strategic benefit. It will sell arms as part of one of the thriving sectors of the United States economy, the manufacturing and sale of arms. And as you heard Bill Bloom just say, the United States actually has been arming even Al-Qaeda. So when it seeks to make these arguments, these high morals that it invokes, as the president is doing nonstop, talking about the United States in a way as if he doesn't either understand history, or he intentionally ignores history, or he refuses to even recognize that the entire world has a long record of U.S. Involvement. I wanted to read for you, because there's no other way at the moment for me to do it. I will later post a link to it on the Facebook page. But I located an article from the Washington Post dated December the 30th, 2002, written by Michael Dobbs. And it says, the U.S. had key role in Iraq buildup. Trade in chemical arms allowed despite their use on Iranians and Kurds. So this article relates to an immediate, a prequel of where the United States is now with respect to Syria, but in the same region. The United States actually was supplying chemical weapons that ultimately were used by Saddam Hussein, who was then the darling of the United States, against Iranians and Kurds. And I will read as much as I can to get through this article to give you an idea of the hypocrisy at play. It begins. High on the Bush administration's list of justifications for war against Iraq are President Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons, nuclear and biological programs, and his contacts with international terrorists. What U.S. officials rarely acknowledge is that these offenses date back to a period when Hussein was seen in Washington as a valued ally. Among the people instrumental in tilting U.S. policy toward Baghdad during the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq War was Donald H. Rumsfeld, now Defense Secretary, whose December 1983 meeting with Hussein as a special presidential envoy paved the way for normalization of U.S.-Iraqi relations. Declassified documents show that Rumsfeld traveled to Baghdad at a time when Iraq was using chemical weapons on an almost daily basis in defiance of international conventions. The story of U.S. involvement with Saddam Hussein in the years before his 1990 attack on Kuwait, which included large-scale intelligence sharing, supply of cluster bombs through a Chilean front company, and facilitating Iraq's acquisition of chemical and biological precursors, is a topical example of the underside of U.S. foreign policy. It is a world in which deals can be struck with dictators, human rights violations sometimes overlooked, and accommodations made with arms proliferations, all on the principle that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Throughout the 1980s, Hussein's Iraq was the sworn enemy of Iran, then still in the throes of an Islamic revolution. U.S. officials saw Baghdad as a bulwark against militant Shiite extremism and the fall of pro-American states such as Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and even Jordan, a Middle East version of the domino theory in Southeast Asia. That was enough to turn Hussein into a strategic partner and for U.S. diplomats in Baghdad to routinely refer to Iraqi forces as the good guys, in contrast to the Iranians, who were depicted as the bad guys. A review of thousands of declassified government documents and interviews with former policymakers shows that U.S. intelligence and logistical support played a crucial role in shoring up Iraqi defenses against the human wave attacks by suicidal Iranian troops. The administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush authorized the sale to Iraq of numerous items that had both military and civilian applications, including poisonous chemicals and deadly biological viruses such as anthrax and bubonic plague. Opinions differ among Middle East experts and former government officials about the pre-Iraqi tilt and whether Washington could have done more to stop the flow to Baghdad of technology for building weapons of mass destruction. It was a horrible mistake then, but we have got it right now, says Kenneth M. Pollack, a former CIA military analyst and author of The Threatening Storm, which makes the case for war with Iraq. My fellow CIA analysts and I were warning at the time that Hussein was a very nasty character. We were constantly fighting the State Department. Fundamentally, the policy was justified, argues David Newton, a former U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, who runs an anti-Hussein radio station in Prague. We were concerned that Iraq should not lose the war with Iran, because that would have threatened Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. Our long-term hope was that Hussein's government would become less repressive and more responsible. What makes present-day Hussein different from the Hussein of the 1980s, say Middle East experts, is the mellowing of the Iranian Revolution and the August 1990 invasion of Kuwait that transformed the Iraqi dictator almost overnight from awkward ally to mortal enemy. In addition, the United States itself has changed. As a result of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, U.S. policymakers take a much more alarmist view of the threat posed by the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. When the Iran-Iraq War began in September 1980, with an Iraqi attack across the Shatt al-Arab waterway that leads to the Persian Gulf, the United States was a bystander. The United States did not have diplomatic relations with either Baghdad or Tehran. U.S. officials had almost as little sympathy for Hussein's dictatorial brand of Arab nationalism as for the Islamic fundamentalism espoused by Iran's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. As long as the two countries fought their way to a stalemate, nobody in Washington was disposed to intervene. By the summer of 1982, however, the strategic picture had changed dramatically. After its initial gains, Iraq was on the defensive, and Iranian troops had advanced to within a few miles of Basra, Iraq's second largest city. U.S. intelligence information suggested the Iranians might achieve a breakthrough on the Basra front, destabilizing Kuwait, the Gulf states, and even Saudi Arabia, thereby threatening U.S. oil supplies. You have to understand the geostrategic context, which was very different from where we are now, said Howard Teicher, a former National Security Council official who worked on Iraqi policy during the Reagan administration. Realpolitik dictated that we act to prevent the situation from getting worse. To prevent an Iraqi collapse, the Reagan administration supplied battlefield intelligence on Iranian troop buildups to the Iraqis, sometimes through third parties such as Saudi Arabia. The U.S. tilt toward Iraq was enshrined in National Security Decision Directive 114 of November 26, 1983, one of the few important Reagan-era foreign policy decisions that still remains classified. According to former U.S. officials, the directive stated that the United States would do, quote, whatever was necessary and legal, unquote, to prevent Iraq from losing the war with Iran. The presidential directive was issued amid a flurry of reports that Iraqi forces were using chemical weapons in their attempts to hold back the Iranians. In principle, Washington was strongly opposed to chemical warfare, a practice outlawed by the 1925 Geneva Protocol. In practice, U.S. condemnation of Iraqi use of chemical weapons ranked relatively low on the scale of administration priorities, particularly compared with the all-important goal of preventing an Iranian victory. Thus, on November 1st, 1983, A senior State Department official, Jonathan T. Howe, told Secretary of State George P. Shultz that intelligence reports showed that Iraqi troops were resorting to, quote, almost daily use of CW, meaning chemical weapons, against the Iranians. But the Reagan administration had already committed itself to a large-scale diplomatic and political overture to Baghdad, culminating in several visits by the president's recently appointed special envoy to the Middle East, Donald H. Rumsfeld. Secret talking points prepared for the first Rumsfeld visit to Baghdad enshrined some of the language from NSDD-14, including the statement that the United States would regard, quote, any major reversal of Iraq's fortunes as a strategic defeat for the West, unquote. When Rumsfeld finally met with Hussein on December the 20th, he told the Iraqi leader that Washington was ready for a resumption of full diplomatic relations, according to a State Department report of the conversion of the conversation. Iraqi leaders later described themselves as extremely pleased with what Rumsfeld said, which had elevated U.S.-Iraqi relations to a new level. In a September interview with CNN, Rumsfeld said he cautioned Hussein about the use of chemical weapons, a claim at odds with declassified State Department notes of his 90-minute meeting with the Iraqi leader. A Pentagon spokesman, Brian Whitman, now says that Rumsfeld raised the issue not with Hussein, but with Iraqi former minister Tariq Aziz. The State Department notes show that he mentioned it largely in passing as one of the several matters that, quote, inhibited, unquote, U.S. efforts to assist Iraq. Rumsfeld has also said he had nothing to do with helping Iraq in its war against Iran, although former U.S. officials agree that Rumsfeld was not one of the architects of the administration's tilt toward Iraq. He was a private citizen when he was appointed Middle East envoy. The documents show that his visits to Baghdad led to closer U.S.-Iraqi cooperation on a wide variety of fronts. Washington was willing to resume diplomatic relations immediately, but Hussein insisted on delaying such a step until the following year. The article goes on to describe how the United States decided that it was in its strategic interest to ally itself closer, much more closer to Iraq and to somehow assist in the defeat of Iran. But the key to all of this was the supply of weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction under the Reagan administration. I will go through here. It's a substantial article, so I wouldn't be able to finish it. But I want to talk about this section. I'll read this section to you again. I'm reading from an article published in the Washington Post on December the 30th, 2002, called U.S. Had Key Role in Iraq Buildup. Trade in Chemical Arms Allowed Despite Their Use on Iranians and Kurds. So the United States actually had an ongoing policy of supplying chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons, to dictatorial governments, to which the United States decided to cozy up if there were a strategic advantage. So the president's contention today and his moral outrage is to be seen in this context. The United States does not have clean hands here. I'll read you this section, which brings us up to 1987. In late 1987, the Iraqi Air Force began using chemical agents against Kurdish resistance forces in northern Iraq that had formed a loose alliance with Iran, according to State Department reports. The attacks, which were part of a scorched earth strategy to eliminate rebel-controlled villages, provoked outrage on Capitol Hill and renewed demands for sanctions against Iraq. The State Department and White House were also outraged, but not to the point of doing anything that might seriously damage relations with Baghdad. The Bush administration spokesmen have cited Hussein's use of chemical weapons, quote, against his own people, unquote. You've heard that phrase many times. And particularly the March 1988 attack on the Kurdish village of Halabja, to bolster the argument that his regime presents, quote, a grave and gathering danger, unquote, to the United States. The Iraqis continued to use chemical weapons against the Iranians until the end of the Iran-Iraq War. A U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, Rick Francona, reported finding widespread use of Iraqi nerve gas when he toured the Al-Faw Peninsula in southern Iraq in the summer of 1988 after its recapture by the Iraqi army. The battlefield was littered with atropine injectors used by panicky Iranian troops as an antidote against Iraqi nerve gas attacks. Far from declining, the supply of U.S. military intelligence to Iraq actually expanded in 1988, according to a 1999 book by Francona titled Ally to Adversary, an eyewitness account of Iraq's fall from grace. Informed sources said much of the battlefield intelligence was channeled to the Iraqis by the CIA office in Baghdad. Although U.S. export controls to Iraq were tightened up in the 1980s, there were still many loopholes. In December 1988, Dow Chemical sold 1.5 million of pesticides to Iraq, despite U.S. government concerns that they could be used as chemical warfare agents. An export-import bank official reported in a memorandum that he could find no reason to stop the sale, despite evidence that the pesticides were, quote, highly toxic, unquote, to humans and would cause death from asphyxiation. The U.S. policy of cultivating Hussein as a moderate and reasonable Arab leader continued right up until he invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, documents show. When the then U.S. ambassador to Baghdad, April Glaspie, met with Hussein on July the 25th, 1990, a week before the Iraqi attack on Kuwait, she assured him that Bush, quote, wanted better and deeper relations, unquote, according to an Iraqi transcript of the conversation. Quote, President Bush is an intelligent man, unquote, the ambassador told Hussein, referring to the father of the current president. He is not going to declare an economic war against Iraq. Everybody was wrong in their assessment of Saddam, said Joe Wilson, Glaspie's former deputy at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and the last U.S. official to meet with Hussein. Quote, everybody in the Arab world told us that the best way to deal with Saddam was to develop a set of economic and commercial relationships that would have the effect of moderating his behavior. History will demonstrate that this was a miscalculation. You should go to the site and take a look at it. And what this communicates, and this is just up until fairly recently, you'd say, the United States has supplied, certainly in this case, the United States supplied Iraq with chemicals and weapons and biological weapons of mass destruction. And we have a history of the country, I should say. I wouldn't use the word we. The United States as a country has had a long relationship with chemical and biological weapons for export and even for domestic use. For example, I direct you to if you're taking notes, I direct you to an edition of Counterpunch, which is an online magazine, in their September 5th edition, which puts out in the September the 2nd, this is dated September the 2nd, and it's titled The Pot Calling the Kettle Black, A Short History of Biochemical Weapons. The author, the reporter, is Zoltan Grossman, and he details, it's a very long list, very comprehensive list, he details how the United States and its allies have long been complicit, he says, in the manufacturing and use of biological and chemical weapons, yet has targeted other countries for alleged possession and use of these same weapons. This partial chronology, and I'm telling you it is quite detailed, is intended as a starting point for critical research and analysis of biochemical weaponry and foreign policy. And it begins at 400 BC to our time today. We will have some other guests and try to locate the original authors of these articles. But I urge you to look at them and see that when the United States makes these charges on the international level, the heads of state actually snicker and laugh because they know differently. And this is why the President of the United States today in Russia for the G20 summit, which is supposed to be dealing with international regulation of commerce and trade and economies, finds himself somewhat lonely because the international world community is hip to the hypocrisy of the United States. And there ought to be some kind of movement, one would think, especially in Congress, when this president says, I need Congress to sanction my intended act as an authority unto myself, and meaning the country, that the United States is an authority unto itself. What the president is actually doing and what these legislators fail to understand is that they are legitimizing something, the intimate details of which they do not know. But they're around long enough, it seems to me, and they have access to records and history. They're around long enough to begin to ask these questions. What is the United States' role in weapons, creating and selling weapons of mass destruction? What is our responsibility as a nation in this ugly practice? In fact, right in the United States, according to this Counterpunch list, we have firms actually manufacturing these toxic products, right in the middle of residential or close to communities that could be immediately affected. But the United States certainly is hypocritical when it points an accusing finger at other countries to say they're using weapons of mass destruction, but suddenly the United States is exempt and it has clean hands and it comes in like the agent of retribution, highly moral retribution, to exact punishment on these errant dictatorial evil empires. Really, as Counterpunch says, it's a case of the pot calling the kettle black. That brings us to the end of our program today. I thought I would again remind you how to get to the Empire Report, which is worth reading. It certainly is. It's Bill Blum, BLUM.org. That's easy to do. The article that I've just read, you should go online and get it from the Washington Post. Let me get that information to you. This article I got, in fact, it is titled, The U.S. Had Key Role in Iraq Buildup, December the 30th, 2002, printed in the Washington Post. The author is Michael Dobbs. So we'll see each other again tomorrow, I hope at 1 p.m. Sorry we didn't get much chance to basically interact today. This being a short week, we'll do that tomorrow. We'll continue the conversation, and that's really what it will be, where we can all talk to each other tomorrow, and we will round out the week that way. But in the meantime, thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company, and keep it right here at PRN. Of course, you know that the website is undergoing some changes, and in the meantime, you still can access, of course, all of the backlogged, or I should say archived, I should say backlogged, that's a bad word, archived files that you may want to reach. You get them from podbean.com/lead stories. So it's leadstories.podbean.com. Okay? Leadstories.podbean.com. That gets you everything you would need while the website is being overhauled and upgraded. And one last thing I want to say is we have coming up next Mike Feder with Occupied Territory. You want to stay right here with us at WBA. Did I say that? Back to the old days, right here at PRN.FM. And you certainly can drop me a line. Also, email me at leadstories@gmail.com. Thanks so much. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.